Welcome to the LGBTQ Plus Rights Pride and the Law, a podcast. My name is Maria Hawk. I am the founder and creator of this podcast. This is a project under the LGBTQ Plus / HIV Essex Law Clinic designed as a podcast. Students from the Essex Law Clinic will hold semi-structured interviews with interested members of the LGBTQ Plus community. The research is aimed at sharing the stories of LGBTQ Plus members by highlighting discriminative policies and legal practices that resulted in the violation of their fundamental rights. This can include, but is not limited to, discrimination, human rights and law violation. There are three main objectives behind the study. First is to provide public legal information. The Essex Law Clinic will gather useful information to educate the public about existing resources in order to face the kind of legal challenges discussed in the podcasts. Second, we are here to support the LGBTQ plus community. Participants are given a safe environment to speak freely and gain the support that they need. Last but not least, we want to increase the visibility of the LGBTQ plus community. Many individuals from various religious and cultural backgrounds are not visible members of the LGBT community due to fear and threatened safety of coming out. The podcasts work to challenge these barriers and make visible all LGBTQ plus voices. Please note that the views shared in these podcasts do not represent that of the University of Essex. We are not in partnership with any organizations to advertise or to promote any given perspectives. The opinions our participants share are entirely their own and at their discretion. Joining us as our first participant is Vinush Kumar. We sincerely hope you enjoy this conversation. I will see you shortly again after the interview. Hi, Vinush. How are you today?
I'm well. Thank you, Maria. Thank you for introducing me. Hello to everyone who's listening. My name is Vinush. I did my undergraduate law degree at Essex from 2016 to 2020. After I graduated, I actually went on a sabbatical year to do the role of Vice President of Welfare. I'm currently pursuing my master's in social work at the moment.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. So while you were at the University of Essex, you did a really strong dissertation on the situation of refugees and the LGBTQ plus community, along with their experiences in the law.
Yes. So my dissertation touched on LGBT plus asylum seekers in particular, and when they the process of applying for asylum essentially within the UK refugee system. And it focused a lot on the pitfalls and the kind of barriers, the access to advice that most refugees need that they never get access to, and how that essentially has a knock-off effect on how the system processes cases in particular. And the focus, essentially, my dissertation discussed about the issues that the Home Office currently face and kind of simple solutions that will really help mainstream the process in particular. So that was what my dissertation mainly focused on.
It's a really interesting topic, and I would like to get into more detail without, I'm sure there were a lot of cases that you looked at as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, without getting into the finer details of the cases for the sake of confidentiality,
absolutely,
what were the kind of key findings you found in terms of how refugees and asylum seekers were facing in the UK in terms of, you know, as a member of the LGBTQ plus community?
Yeah. I think it's really interesting to see the changes that the system has brought us, especially in the past 20 years. There have been many landmark cases that have been published that most law students would be familiar with, particularly when you come from a human rights background. One of the things that I can really think about, the most publicized case, was Hey Shea in Iran, because it essentially re-evaluated how the interpretation of not only human rights was, but how individual rights are for refugees who come from another country into the UK. So it's very interesting to observe how, as a society, sometimes, you know, what we write in theory isn't necessarily what is interpreted in, you know, black letter law, essentially. During the time that I did my research, it was very fascinating to see how the comparisons of not only the UK system, which I did go quite a bit into detail of, is to see how the interpretation of westernization, particularly in the UK, where we focus on, is very different from how other countries interpret it. For example, the argument is always, from a UK perspective, is about how, if we do repatriate LGBT plus asylum seekers, you know, what is the knockoff effect of how they will live in that society, you know? And most of the cases when they are being interpreted, the biggest thing that decision makers take into account is, if we send them back, how will they live? That's not necessarily a question that we would usually see that is being asked. But in this particular case, people tend to always think that societal acceptance is a lot more important than legal protection. And I saw this a lot when I drew comparisons to other Commonwealth countries in particular. So I did a comparison when it came to South Africa. Apartheid played a very big role in how asylum seekers were interpreted in their legal system. We see in India the kind of changes in attitude that we see in society, where there's only one basic legal right, which is same-sex sexual relations. That's essentially the only right that they had. And there was so much controversy around it when it was being redacted and then reintroduced again as being legal. And we see in countries like Malaysia, where I'm from, where it has been illegal, you know, because of not only legal situations, but also the cultural importance of it being illegal. But it's very hard to quantify the experiences of asylum seekers. And that's why it's so important to hear their stories to change the perception of how we see them. Because I think at the end of the day, whether you're an LGBT plus asylum seeker or an asylum seeker in general, there's the hostility towards you, not only from the legal system, but also the people who are interpreting the cases. So that was really what I wanted to focus on to you know, in obviously due to confidentiality, we discussed already, Maria, not to get into too much of the cases, but hearing those individual stories is what made the bulk of my dissertation a lot more kind of in depth, because it's from these lived experiences that we really understand. Very often, the law doesn't necessarily protect the citizen. So that's something that was really eye-opening to me when I was doing my research.
I like what you brought up earlier about the difference between legal protection and societal acceptance. And I kind of want to hone in more into that, because that's such an interesting, because those two things, they influence each other. The people who sometimes, the populations and the groups of people who are who do get legal protection, they, because they get legal protection, they also get societal acceptance.
Yes.
That sometimes influences how society treats them and looks at them. Because if the government accepts you, then I guess it's okay for us to also sort of integrate you into our society.
Yeah.
But if the government does not protect you, then there must be a reason why they're not. Maybe you're not really good for this community. Maybe you're not deserving of that protection, and that really changes their perception of you. So the law really does influence society and our attitudes towards different groups of people. I know, for instance, in my home country, in Bangladesh, we definitely don't have any laws protecting the LGBTQ plus community. It's we have a really large transgender community, which we call HIDRAs. Are you familiar with that?
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. HIDRAs. So they, of course, they don't have any legal protection. And because of that, the government decided to give them a different kind of platform. They almost made them, and it's really interesting, and I just recently learned about this. So because they know people are not going to accept them, because they know they're not going to get any job or have those kind of same rights as everybody else, they are in a way put on a what they call above the law. So they are allowed to get away with certain crimes and certain things that we would normally get put into jail for. So they will let them steal from stores. And even if they call the police, you're not going to do anything about it, because that's that's kind of their right. They almost get away with a lot of things in order to compensate for the fact that they don't have legal protection, which is even worse, because now they're criminals because they can get away with this. So they become criminals. And unfortunately, that the only way they can live is to is through crime now, because they're allowed to do it, and they're not allowed to do they're not getting any other way to live a better life. So that kind of becomes who they are. They're literally a product of policies and their environment, and people look down upon them because they're like, well, why would they do this? And it's like, what else? They don't have anything.
Yeah.
The only way they can get money is to take people, is to take children hostage and try to sort of use these, which I'm not, you know, I'm sure even if they had a better way, if they had other ways to have a better living, they would not be stealing. They would not be taking children hostages to get money from the parents. And that's just that this is the only way for them to live now is to do these things. And it really shows how when legal protection is taken away, what they're given to be compensated for that and how that makes them, it's almost like it's done on purpose to make them even more isolated, right?
Absolutely. And I think, kind of you speak it from a Bangladeshi perspective as well. And, kind of I grew up in Malaysia until I was at the age of 18. And you kind of see how this fear mongering really A, not only pushes people away from mainstream community because they feel different, they don't have the support or the access or the information that they need to actually come out of that situation. And they are very, very lucky. Most LGBT plus teenagers, what happens is that they move to bigger cities, to capital cities, where generally speaking, in any capital city, you'll see there is more open-mindedness around more taboo topics that the nation doesn't necessarily talk about. And what happens, particularly with transgender individuals, because we see this a lot in Malaysia, not only from my own observation, but from, literature that you can read, transgender individuals are at most risk within the LGBTQ plus community because they need access not only to counseling to understand what's going on with them, but many of them want to transition and choose to transition, and they need appropriate medical facilities and care to do so. And what happens is that they are often, they are very lucky that they are able to find each other and form a community to support on each other, because that's, it's very sad to say, but what essentially happens is that you become a refugee in your own country because you don't have the ability to access the basic services that what society would define as a normal citizen would have to. Because if you go to a medical facility where you say, actually, I need hormone therapy induction or anything, the medical authorities will essentially refer you to the police. And then that causes you to get a brush with the law. And so many transgender individuals to this very day resort to prostitution because that is the only way to make money and support themselves. And the end of the day, they are humans. They either have to go into prostitution or they have to resort to begging on the streets because society refuses to accept them. The legal system doesn't have any loophole to save them. And they are constantly in this circular act where they have to fend for themselves until they are either able to save enough money to go abroad to have an operation or to buy a plane ticket to seek refuge in another country. And even then, they consistent this consistent cycle of difficulties that they weigh that they face brings down their their morale to keep going forward, because each individual can only put up with so much before they reach a breaking point. So I think, there's so much that needs to go into supporting individuals, especially because, as part of my dissertation as well, I focused a lot on how the Commonwealth essentially could do a lot more to support countries. There's a lot of political economic discourse in there, so we won't get into that because that's a very long topic on itself. But to this very day, it's still illegal to be LGBT plus in 73 countries around the world. So I think that speaks volumes as to what we as society, when we live in nations where it's normalized already, we tend to forget how much work still needs to be done in order to support these communities. So I think there's still so much work that needs to be done, not only from a legal perspective, but from a social perspective as well, to change perception ideas to support these people.
In countries outside of the UK and North America, a lot of the LGBTQ plus youth, especially, and adults, and the thing is, those countries are not, it's kind of like what you're saying. When transgender youth or adults have to sort of resort to prostitution as their way to live, they become prostitutes. If you're gay, if you're a lesbian, if you're transgender, that ultimately means you're a prostitute. That means you're dirty, because those are the individuals that have identified as a member of that community. So those are the labels that get associated with them. I know, in the religious institutions and churches and mosques, you have the priest preying on young boys. And that becomes another label, another toxic label of being gay. If you're a gay man, if you're a gay woman, that means this is kind of things that you do. And the kind of examples they get exposed to are sort of like the, it's not about
your sexuality doesn't make you bad. It's about who you are that makes you, you know, what you are, right?
Yeah.
They don't really look at that. They kind of use sexuality to define your morality and your character. And they're, and because of these examples of the people who actually do harm other people, that has got nothing to do with their sexuality, but because of who they are as a person. Yeah. But because those two get associated with each other, it makes it more difficult for anyone else to also identify and express their sexuality because they think they'll also be categorized in that same group. It just shows that how people really have to sort of live in fear all the time. And that there's, I'm sure, and the thing is, a lot of these countries are dominated by the religions. The governments sort of operate through religion.
Definitely.
And in the, unfortunately, you know, Islam and Muslim, that's, you know, that's the dominating religions in my home country. It has such a bad name because of the way that government uses the religion to justify their treatment of the LGBTQ plus community. Yeah. And I know more and more now they're trying to have more institutions and more organizations where they're trying to say, you know what, you can be Muslim, you can be whatever religion you are, and God will still accept you. And it's so, and this is just a, like a new concept that's just emerging that, because even people of the LGBTQ plus community, even they, a lot of them that I've talked to, they internalize those beliefs that they will go to hell because that's what they were being told. And now, you know, the voices are rising. A lot of youth are coming together and challenging that. It's rare. It's still very, you know, it's just peaking the surface, but it's still happening.
Yeah.
So, you know, based on your, is Malaysia dominantly Islam or is it?
Yeah, so Malaysia is a country where Islam is the official religion, but because of mass immigration, especially before independence, one of the things that's very stressed, or right, that's very stressed, is the freedom of religion. So the other predominant religions are normally Buddhism, Christianity, and Hinduism. But it's very interesting that you said that, because one of the phrases that keeps popping up in my head is stigmatization comes from illegalization. Because what we often see that happens in this country is A, politicians use it as a scapegoat to fearmonger the community into thinking that this is a either a Western propaganda or propaganda that doesn't exist for people of this nation, when actually, you know, LGBT people don't choose to be identifying as a sexual minority. It's who they are. And kind of changing this concept is very difficult, because what you essentially have is an imbalance of power. When you illegalize something, i.e. someone's sexual orientation, what you are saying to them repeatedly is, you may identify with this, or, you know, for a lack of people who don't understand sexuality or spectrum, they say you choose to be this. It doesn't matter how much debate we have, because at the end of the day, I am legally right and you are legally wrong. So when you use the word legal itself, you kind of create this fear into someone who says, you know, whatever happens, if I am being reported, I will be thrown into jail. So it doesn't give any room for the for those difficult conversations to be had about changing perception again. And so we, you know, like I said before, we're kind of in this repetitive cycle where it's really hard to break the mold from there. And you've got people like me who essentially were very lucky, or were in a position to leave our home countries and kind of live a better life here. But, you know, for every success story that we see, there are hundreds of people who are still suffering in that environment, in that place. And it's really about how we look forward, extending our hand that we're in a better position to support people who come after us or even before us. So I think there's definitely a lot of work that needs to be done there.
So I'm curious. So in Malaysia, if a child, adult, openly expresses their sexuality, how are they treated? Do they get, you know, is it hormonal therapy like it was in North America back in the days? Is it jail time? Is it some sort of institution? What happens to these individuals?
Yeah, so when I was growing up, I still remember the, because, you know, it's still very taboo, and, you know, people still don't really talk about it. When children tend to openly identify, they used to send them to kind of rehabilitation camps where they would pump you up with all of the religious doctrines that they could find and try to force you to essentially convert to heterosexuality. I still remember when I was in primary school where, you know, there were stories where there were kids who were effeminate, particularly boys, where they would say, actually, you have to go to rehabilitation camp now. So it's very much a real thing, and it's a scary thing. Like, growing up in that environment, you always think, oh God, maybe I'm the next one. kind of thing. So it's you know, kind of looking back and thinking about it even just kind of makes me think like, wow, you know, just because the last 4 or 5 years I've kind of immersed myself in a country where it's fine doesn't necessarily mean like those problems have gone away. It's still happening, and it's scary to think the psychological impacts that it has on these young people who don't really know what's going on, are being forced to believe that their core identity is wrong. So it's still very normal to send people to rehabilitation camps, and you know, it's scary, but it is the truth. You know, it's still happening. So it's and this is where we come back to kind of revisiting that conversation on religion itself and how it legally has a grip hold over states and how people perform their actions or believe in things that they believe, because you know, you've got this indoctrination essentially of religion. And you know, in Malaysia, you basically split the legal system. You've got Sharia law, which most people of the Islamic faith are adherent to, and then you've got civil law, where you've got, you know, the non-Muslims who you know, that's the system for them. Particularly when it comes to family and marriage, that's the kind of the legal system that we use. However, even in a country where there's a split legal system to kind of boost and understand that there's freedom of religion, you see the cultural influence that the Sharia system has over the civil system. You know, for example, it may not necessarily, it is illegal to be gay in civil law and in Sharia law at the moment, but because 60-70% of the population is Muslim and Sharia law is kind of the mainstream court law that's being followed, I find it so hard to encompass a world where the civil law could change when Sharia law is influencing it so much. You know, I have yet to come across a country, you know, especially with a country where Islam is the official religion, where homosexuality has been legalized. You know, I haven't found one yet. I could be very wrong. There could be a country there, but I haven't found it yet. So for me, it's kind of thinking back, even in a multicultural country, it's being very hard. So how do we expect countries within the Arab region, for example, you know, like Libya, Egypt, people, there are LGBT plus people there. There are LGBT plus people in Malaysia. So, you know, it's not a, I always say LGBT people are in a geographical region. They don't necessarily sprout somewhere, don't sprout anywhere else, you know? So it's really about affording those basic rights to people who haven't done anything wrong, you know? And when we see it from a global perspective as well, so many legal scholars often say it's about allowing culture to catch up with time. When in reality, it's you know, we see countries going in a kind of two-way split direction, because there are countries that are getting a lot worse. In Uganda, they've recently, you know, they had a politician who outwardly said, you know what, if my son was gay, I'd stone him to death. And it was completely acceptable at that time. So we kind of, you know, we kind of see why people are fleeing these countries, because they have no choice. Their life and liberty are in danger. And so it really kind of questions, again, we come back to a UK-centric perspective where we're saying, actually, the amount of scrutiny that goes into someone who's claiming asylum, that decision process itself is so rigid, because you're not taking into the account over the fact that someone does not choose to leave their home country behind, leave essentially everything that they have to come to a country where they are seeking refuge simply because it is legal. You know, some people don't even know the English language. Some people know very minimal English language. It comes back to that question, that word, why? You know, think about it from a humanity perspective instead of a quotas perspective, because that's what the Home Office has done over the past few years. You know, they've always been very prioritized of keeping the numbers down, keeping, you know, the immigration numbers down, when in reality, these people actually need to be here to be alive. So that's, you know, one of the things that I would really push for, that I am planning to push for the rest of my academic career, at least, is to really humanize that element. Because we as people, I think, you know, as not even academics, but as students, you know, as young people, we are understanding that nothing is ever black and white. You know, there is so much grayness, whether it's within the law, whether it's making decisions on a case or interpreting a case, you know, when it comes to that final decision, we need to ensure that we have taken all the steps that we need to make a right decision. And that's the other issue that we see all the time, that decisions aren't necessarily being made right, because perceptions and stigma always play a big role in that decision-making process.
Absolutely. I remember years ago talking with someone, so she's Canadian Caucasian, and we were talking about the Pride Parade.
Yeah.
And she made a statement sort of questioning that. And she's not, she's definitely not against the community. I mean, she's definitely for and a huge advocate and supporter.
Yeah.
But even then, there's still so much that a lot of non-immigrants don't understand about the normalization of your sexuality in our communities in particular, because it might be normalized for the Western communities, at least, a lot more than it was back in the years before. I'm sure in some families it's still very stigmatized.
Yeah.
But in the larger mainstream, you do see more Caucasian representation of the LGBTQ plus community in the films, in media, a lot more than you would of people of color. So she was saying, the pride, being gay is normalized now. And I'm like, what do you mean it's normalized? She's like, it's totally normal. I'm like, okay, if I go to my parents and tell them, hey, I think I like women, do you actually believe that I will be treated okay? And this is, my life's going to be okay. And she's like, oh yeah, no, because she knows I'm a color. She knows my background is completely different. And definitely completely changed her answer after that. And it goes to show that when you're in a privileged group and when you're getting these rights, you really don't consider, and not because you're doing it on purpose, but just because they're not always educating everyone the same way. They might be telling our communities one thing, but there are a lot of other communities, like the Western families, where they just don't know, because they don't get the same information that we do.
Yeah.
So for them, it's like, oh, it's normal for everyone, until you tell them, actually, it's not normal for me, for him, or for her. And then suddenly it's like, oh, we didn't even think about that. Just because sometimes when anytime any group gets a lot of better treatment, better rights, it's hard for them to see outside of that box. And it just shows how divided that can make people just with lack of knowledge alone, not because they're doing it intentionally or that they're bad people. Mm-hmm. They just don't know. And it's sort of like, who's accountable for that? How come not everyone knows the same things that they should?
I think as I'm delving more into academia in a lot of ways, I am acutely and fully aware of how much race and culture plays a very big role in the interpretation, normalization, no matter where you are. Because even if you look at it from a UK perspective, there are a lot of South Asian men, a lot of Black men who are still afraid of coming out because they make a choice. It's either be safe with the state and live, independently, or cut all familial ties with their families. And even then, a lot of immigrant families, especially you see in the second generation and the third generation even, so much of the rooted culture that comes is that, yes, we may live in a Caucasian majority country, but we still hold on to our values. We're here for a better life, not necessarily a changing of the culture, the changing of the narrative within the family. So that in itself makes you realize that there's not, that change is becoming slowly, gradually unfolding itself. Yes, we have, people like myself, even, I've met lawyers and doctors and people in the professional academic world where they've come out because they wanted to set a different precedent. But the sacrifices and the costs that come with that are associated with it. Some of them don't speak to their families anymore. Some of them, have cut all ties with their families. Some are still being threatened by their families. So we see this experience that comes with someone who is a person of color or someone who is BAME is very different from that Caucasian perspective. I still remember reading an article, and it was a very interesting article. One of the things I hate is that I cannot find that article. I don't remember where it was. It was very interesting to see because the person who wrote it was a Black man who observed the gay rights movement in particular. And he said, if you notice, every time an LGBT plus person is trailblazing, it's always the gender and race card. You've always got the white man pioneering, and then you go all the way down to the black woman who's disabled. And to a great extent, if you see the observation of the legal movement, even it is true, most landmark cases are won by white men, and then goes down to white women, and then it slowly trickles down, because at the end of the day, they reap the privilege of their race a lot quicker than their sexuality, because you can inherently see it. So it's a very interesting, it was a very interesting biopsy, essentially, of how, you know, race still plays such a significant factor in the rationalization of rights today. So, you know, I think there's so much work still to be done, again, about normalizing BAME experiences, intersectionality, that's the word, of sexuality and race, and how that influences how people come out, how they are interpreting the world, and how they're finding a place for themselves within it. But yeah.
It's really interesting that you said that, you know, because the race is something you can see, and what people see is how they give credibility. Yes. And it's true in the media, the reason the first people who have openly expressed sexuality were white people. And through them, people of color began to sort of jump on that platform. But it began with white people in the very beginning, because people in general credit Western individuals a lot more. And yeah. This could be all going back to colonization, you know, the whole idea of the dominant race and how they kind of take the lead, and what they do first is what's right, and then we follow. So this all goes back to a very historical Absolutely. Events of what we believe, the people we believe to have the merits to say something first, and then we can be like, well, okay, then I guess it's okay to follow along with it. And go ahead.
Yeah, no. I 100% agree. You know, we even when we see, and this is why I stressed on the Commonwealth a bit earlier, because most of the times when we see historical perspectives legally, there were no particular laws banning LGBT plus relationships or their marriages. In fact, I think before the colonization of Malaysia, and it was known as Malaya before then, transgender individuals were celebrated. And even in India, historically, transgender individuals, and that's why I remember, you know, with the way when you said hijra, that's why I remember when they were invited to weddings, culturally significant, when they attended a wedding, it means the marriage was blessed, that children would be born and the family would be very fruitful. So I definitely credit colonization a lot for why many Commonwealth countries, you know, it was the penal code essentially from the British Empire that made same-sex relationships illegal. And now, because of the stigma that was reintroduced onto that penal code, it's never been undone. And many countries hide behind the fact that, oh, we don't enforce it. And I say, not enforcing it and having it still are two very different things, because at the end of the day, you can use a law that is legally there, that is backed by statute and case law, to use it to your advantage when you want it. And that's why when you see asylum cases, sometimes people say, well, actually, because when asylum cases are being decided in the UK, they actually have a list of the latest news of LGBT movements within that country. A lot of the times you'd be absolutely shocked how people say, oh, you know, it's not being used, so it's fine if we send them back, they'll be fine. When actually, when something does go wrong, or they need to seek benefits when their partner passes away, there's no recognition of that relationship. So there's so many legal issues that are being faced. And the simplest thing that you know, from a Western perspective, what they say is, you know, it's not being enforced, so it's fine, but it's not as simple as that. So I definitely credit colonization a lot to the problems and the issues that people face today. Particularly LGBT plus people.
I actually had no idea that these communities once used to be more accepted, and that colonization codes kind of reversed that. And then now they might be re-reversing it in their countries, in the colonization countries, but not in the countries that were colonized, because they sort of internalized those views. That's really interesting. And it shows just how we're always sort of at the mercy of, you know, a dominant country of power, and how we literally are at that mercy, not just because of events that happened before, because colonization, it's not just one couple of years. This is something that takes root in the system. So it's not just an event that happened, it becomes a way of living for generations to come. It becomes rooted in the system. And I think people forget that. People think colonization is something that happened years ago and that's it, we're past that. But it's not. It's not. When you take over people's mindsets like that, it can never just go away in 2-3 years just because the people have left. It gets passed on in the generations through their children, through blood, literally. And it's part of the system. So it's not an event, but it's a system. It's how people end up living. And to decolonize it definitely is a process.
And I think, you know, kind of, and this, you know, in a little way, it does stem back to human nature, Maria, because people, you know, I don't know how it is in Canada, but in the UK, people are very quick to say times have changed when actually liberation movements only started in the 70s and 80s. That's what, about 50, 60 years, give or take? People are so quick to say, oh, you know, the years have gone by, when actually it's been very, very recent. If you look back about 80, 90 years ago, I remember when the entire world was at war, you know? And so it's just, it's this human nature where we quickly forget, because we think we're advancing in a lot of ways, we're not seeing the repercussion that some countries are facing. So it's so important to shed light on the fact that when the world is evolving, everyone does need to catch up at the same time.
And when they say times have changed, you have to really think about times have changed for which people exactly. Maybe for some people, but not for everybody. But it kind of goes back to what I was saying before. For the people who have that privilege, sometimes it's hard for them to see past that. And that's because, not because they're choosing to be that way, maybe some are, but just lack of information, because the media doesn't always capture the things that need to be captured. And we don't always get taught the things that need to be taught. Before we wrap up today, I do want to ask you just a few more questions, short answer.
Yeah, go for it.
So in terms of your personal experiences, which I'm sure so many can relate with, all over the world, how did you, or did you even have this conversation with your parents about your sexuality and what you felt you needed to do to protect yourself?
No, I never had that conversation with my parents, simply because I realized, and, you know, I think a lot of LGBT plus individuals have to grow up a lot quicker than their peers, because they are acutely and fully aware of their position in life. And I never had that conversation with my parents, simply because my goal was to leave the country. And so I was very fortunate that I got a position, you know, to do my undergraduate now and to do my master's here, to kind of be able to feel safe and be safe. And, you know, when I tell people my story, a lot of people sympathize and feel sad about it, when in reality, I kind of say, I don't want to, you know, I don't want people to pity me or feel sad for me. I want to trailblaze away. I see, you know, sometimes when I express this, people kind of think that's a bit big-headed of you, but I say, actually, no, growing up, I never saw anyone like me. And I hope to set a precedent for people who come after me to say, he did it, I can do it as well. And for me, liberating and empowering of communities about that, it's about being able to make the change from yourself to show others that they can do it as well. So I never had that conversation with my parents, to be honest, but I hope to have it in the future.
Completely understandable. You know, the thing is, when I was in university with you, and you were part, when you were a student, you were part of the LGBTQ plus law clinic, and you were one of the student leaders as well, and you were also a color, which for me, because I didn't know you right away, but I remember when I first came into Essex, and all I saw were, it's a very white county for sure.
Yes.
There's very few people of color. So that for me was kind of a bit shocking and taking used to.
Yeah.
So I find that you might have been a really good role model for a lot of international students from different countries, who for them, they were in a county where it's predominantly white people almost anywhere you go.
Yeah.
But then you have the student population where there are a lot more mixing. And then you have someone like you who is a leader in a community where you wouldn't see such things, and probably where they're coming from in their home countries.
Yeah.
So is there anything you would, any advice or any sort of anything you'd like to say to any youth who's in your position where they're trying to either you know, find legal ways to help themselves or legal information? What would you say to these youth or adults?
I would definitely say if you see something or you see, you know, personally, I didn't have any guidance. Whatever I searched for was simply because the internet was there. And one of the greatest things is that the internet is flourishing and growing in every nation. So even if it means putting a private browser tab and kind of searching, what can I do? Do it. Speak to people that you are safe and that you trust, that you know won't betray your trust or, you know, kind of break that confidentiality with you and have those conversations. And one of the biggest things I would say is never be afraid. Because I think fear and shame in particular consumes us a lot in searching for that information. So one of the things I would always say is if you have the opportunity to be somewhere safer, take it. If you have the opportunity to get out of your situation, take it. Don't be afraid to take that first step because it will be the biggest and scariest step. But the minute you start putting your leg forward, you will realize that you are stronger than you think. It's very cliche to say that, but you are stronger than you think. Always take that initial first step. Find that information that you need. Speak to the people that you trust. People will have information. It's literally just about asking them. When you ask them, you'd be surprised at, you know, how much people know, how much resources people will have. I've met many, many students who were in a similar situation to me. And for them, coming to university was the only way to escape their situation. So they applied for scholarships. They looked at grants. So there are options and there are resources for you to do it. Never feel like you're alone, you know, because there are so many people in a similar situation to you that will understand where you're coming from and they will have solutions for you. So reach out. That's the one thing I will always say. Reach out and speak to people.
Thank you so much. Two more questions. In terms of refugees and asylum seekers, sometimes the government will not always recognize these groups of people, and sometimes they will create hostile policies to marginalize them even more. What can the community do, people, the regular people like you and I, how can we support the refugees and asylum seekers in the UK?
It is simply about being able to educate the people that we see. It's about, it can be as simple as volunteering at a LGBT plus charity. Most LGBT plus charities do have a division that you can volunteer and help people who've just come into the country, or they have missions outside in neighboring countries. For example, in Africa, I know that there's some work, I forgot the name of the particular charity, but there is some work that South African LGBT plus communities are doing to simply raise awareness to neighboring countries that they can come here and be safe. So there's, I would say, volunteering and spreading your knowledge as much as you can. You know, having conversations like this, even, Maria, we don't know who's going to listen to this podcast, so they will know where to seek access to. I would say if you're UK-based, go to Stonewall. They have a lot of information that will be helpful to anyone, whether you're reading up for your own education or wanting to give it to someone, go there. They are leading in the UK, their national charity, so that'd be really helpful. Just kind of having those conversations. I think people like you and me can definitely volunteer more and, you know, kind of spread that information across.
Fantastic. Last question, and we talked about this earlier in our first conversation. Any documentaries, movies, films you would recommend to the audience that might, you know, make them feel a little bit more connected and at ease with their situation?
Yeah, I would definitely say watch Pride. And for people, this is particularly from a South Asian community perspective, there is a Tamil movie on YouTube called My Son is Gay. It's literally, that is the title. The acting was very powerful, and I think it really leans into a lot of South Asian experiences of coming out and really accepting. The movie has a very sweet and bitter message at the same time, but I cried throughout the entire movie because I resonated a lot with what happened. So I would definitely recommend watching you that, because it also reminds you that there is life after coming out. There is life after acceptance, and that is a very big reason for you to understand what's going on.
Thank you so much, Benoush. I hope we get to talk again. There's still so much I want to talk to you about.
Yeah.
Maybe a part two in the future. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you for everyone who's listening. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. And as usual, if you guys want to get in contact with us, our information is going to be in the episode notes. Thank you again so much. We'll see you soon.
Thank you. Bye.
Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed listening to Vinush's insightful knowledge regarding the situation of LGBTQ plus asylum seekers in the UK. Below this podcast, you will find information of various legal resources you can access if you are also an LGBTQ plus asylum seeker. There's also a link provided in the box for additional information. For further help or inquiries, please contact the Essex Law Clinic, where you can access student aid for free legal advice. Should you have any questions directly related to the podcast, perhaps you're interested in being a participant, I am excited to hear from you. Please do not hesitate to get in touch with me. My information is provided in the subtext note below. Take care.